susceptible to the local diseases, whatever, it can spread very quickly.
Mazen Qumsie, what does the future hold in store for Palestine and the Palestinian people, taking out your crystal ball? It doesn't look like a very hopeful future, but what do you think is coming down the pike in the next 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years? Maybe you've got to look further down towards the horizon. And what role does the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability play in helping to restore the land and the people in Palestine?
I mean, it's very simple. If we continue down this path that we have been going on for the past 76 years, which is colonialism, destruction of the environment, and wars, then we are all doomed. Israelis and Palestinians, Jews, Christian, Muslim, we're all doomed, and our nature is doomed. And that's a path we've been on. We have done that, been there, so to speak. We know where it's leading. The other path, which we have not taken yet, not enough people are moving on that direction, which is a road of justice and human rights and equality and environmental justice, climate justice, etc., water justice, so that Palestinians get their fair share of water, etc. That's a decolonizing path. And a decolonizing path is not easy to do, but it must be done if we are to save ourselves and save this country, the geography that is Palestine, that's now under the control of the State of Israel, to make it livable for all human beings, regardless of their religion, but also livable for other species that co-evolved with the local humans over thousands of years.
I kind of say on a pessimistic note that, if Palestine, by the time Palestine becomes free from the river to the sea, if that ever does indeed happen, the Eastern Mediterranean will be a furnace, will be, racing past 2 degrees Celsius post-industrial, and climate change will ravage the region.
Already this season, we have about 50% of the rain that we expected so far this year. So it's horrible. It's going to have a huge impact on agriculture and on the wildlife of Palestine. So I gave you two choices, basically. The first one, if you want to look at me as a pessimistic person, I'd give it actually 70 or 80% chance of happening. And the choice of sustainability and decolonization, maybe 20, 30%. That's if I'm optimistic. It may be even less than that probability of it happening. I'm speaking just as a observing scientist, if you want, looking at the variables, not my wishful thinking. Of course, my wishful thinking is we manage to recruit enough people to push us into that second road to save us and save humanity. That's a choice, by the way, is not just for Palestine, for the whole world. I mean, you look at the US and climate change and fires in California and everything else. Our choices are very stark. We either die together as fools or we live together as fellow human beings with nature in sustainable and harmonious relationship.
Mazen Qumsie is the co-founder and director of the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability in Bethlehem, occupied Palestine. We'll post a link to the institute and a video of our conversation with Mazen Qumsie at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're checking that out, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. It was a dreadful way for a little girl to die, huddled in the back seat of a crushed, bullet-ridden car, stranded at a Gaza City intersection. an Israeli Merkava tank looming meters away, her aunt and uncle dead in the front seat, four cousins dead beside her, seeping blood onto her skirt, sobbing to a Palestinian emergency dispatcher on the other end of a cell phone line, pleading to be rescued, crying out that she was scared. Then, in a torrent of machine gun fire, ripped to bits, Hind Rajab was brutally murdered by an Israeli tank crew a year and a few days ago today. So were a pair of medics from the Palestinian Red Crescent who'd come to rescue her with Israeli military permission. Little Hind was 6 years old. Now, a foundation established in Hind Rajab's name is seeking justice. In an October 8th submission to the International Criminal Court in The Hague, the Brussels-based Hind Rajab Foundation has provided the names of 1,000 Israeli soldiers it thinks the world's top criminal court should prosecute. Among 8,000 pieces of accompanying evidence, the soldiers' own social media posts boasting about blowing up buildings, destroying neighborhoods, looting wrecked Palestinian homes, and gunning down unarmed civilians. I spoke about the Hind Rajab Foundation's work with its lead counsel, Harun Raza. Hello, Harun Raza.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for speaking with us. Who was Hind Rajab?
Well, as you just explained during your intro, she was a little girl who was ripped to pieces by Israeli and possibly U.S. Bullets. I think there were 355, more than 350 bullets, which were fired at her after all the adults and the other children in the vehicle were dead. And that's how they eventually murdered her, IDF. And we were already busy with preparing offensive litigations or cases against Israeli soldiers. And we started before the murder of Hind happened. So we were already busy in December 2023, in fact, via the March 30th movement, which is the umbrella organization under which the Hind Rajab Foundation was formed. However, we felt that it was necessary to have a separate, let's call it a child of the March 30th movement, specialized in offensive litigation and in legally pursuing, you might even say legally hunting, IDF war criminals or other criminals who are responsible for the genocide, which has been happening since the 7th of October. And that's why we thought of our chairman, Abu Jaja, thought of creating this separate entity, which we subsequently did. And we have, as you correctly stated, lodged and filed a complaint at the ICC level against 1,000 IDF war criminals with more than 8,000 pieces of video and photographic evidence. However, we've also sent that evidence to 10 countries, 10 different countries, to the embassies in The Hague, with the explicit request for these countries to put some or all, hopefully, of these war criminals on the arrest warrant list, the national and the international arrest warrant list. And alongside that, we have been quite busy, as you've probably seen. We are lodging new complaints, a few per week, if I'm not mistaken, this week. In fact, as soon as we are done with this interview, I'm working on a new one, which we lodge tonight and publish out tomorrow. So we are going full steam ahead. And wherever we find these Israeli war criminals, we have promised, if you will, the spirit of Hind Rajab to pursue them. So that's what we've been doing since December of 2023. And that's gone into overdrive the past few months.
How have you gone about identifying these thousands soldiers, IOF, Israeli Occupation Force soldiers? And you've gathered together like 8,000 pieces of evidence that you've presented to the ICC. This is astonishing. How have you gone about identifying these individuals and gathering this evidence?
Let me explain in a summarized way. We have our own investigation teams, and we work with other investigators who are all dedicated to the Hind Rajab Foundation. So specifically regarding the 1,000 IDF complaint which we lodged, that was primarily done via our own team and many other external investigators who were helping us, supporting us in this endeavor. And it's all open source information. So it's very simple. Many of these IDF war criminals have been publishing their war crimes quite publicly. And that's why 2 weeks ago, the IDF or IOF leadership asked them officially not to stop committing war crimes. They didn't ask them to do that. They asked them to stop publishing what they were doing. And that makes it easier for us. That proves intent, it proves that they know what their soldiers, men and women, have been doing. Then they're not ashamed of that, but they just don't want them to get into trouble. And that's why they've asked them not to publish it. But anyway, they were publishing everything, and third parties were publishing everything. So let's say you have 10 people in unit. I'm giving you an example, right? They all have social media, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, whatever. And many of them were just, you know, putting group selfies and group photos and showing exactly where they were and what they were doing. So if they blew up a building, they were very proud about it and vocal. And they showed, they published that in their, on their Insta stories, on the TikTok, on Facebook and other social media platforms, which made it extremely easy for us to gather the evidence. The evidence was after that verified through our team and external investigators. And after verification, we've saved everything.
And so you've got individuals out there, like hundreds and hundreds of cooperants who are actually scouring TikTok and X and Facebook and Snapchat and all these other social media platforms, Telegram.
Yeah, that's how we work. It isn't any secret information. There's no hacking. It's all legal. And this has been volunteered by these men and women. So it's very easy. And what's happening now is they're all deleting their profiles, but they forget we've been working for a year. So we have everything. So, you know, it's funny. And in fact, it's interesting to see them deleting everything, knowing in full knowledge of their crimes, knowing that they committed crimes, but they forget internet has a long memory and we've had enough time.
And you're correlating this information with geospatial information that you've co-located and the identity of these soldiers and so on and so forth?
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, what units they belong to. This sounds like a very difficult thing to do.
It isn't, because of the fact that it's time consuming. It was, we've been doing it for a year. So it's extremely time consuming.
You've been doing this starting since when?
So we started in November 2023. And we've been collecting information since, I think it was December 2023. And I'm just giving you the information regarding our own organization, but we have external investigators as well who are working exclusively with us, and they've been doing it on their own. And because of that, we have a massive database of information now, which has been verified, which has been double checked through the information we already had and the information we received, which has been verified, which makes it strong evidence. So in English, you would say Bob's your uncle. It's quite simple. And all we have to do is draw up a complaint on the basis of the evidence which we can see and hear in moving pictures as well as stills, and we present that.
Now, what are the crimes that these soldiers have admitted committing?
I won't say the name. I'll give you an example because I don't have 1,000 names in my head, but I've been busy. I mean, I worked personally on the 1,000 IDF complaint for, I think, 3 or 4 weeks straight, every evening, every morning. So my head is full of all these names and all these pictures. But an example is the torture. So there was one guy, I remember, and he explained what he had been doing to Palestinian hostages, in my view, and the way in which they had been tortured and what he had done. So that was an admission of guilt. That was just what he was saying.
And what had he done?
Beating Palestinian prisoners. I'm giving you an example of beating them. But the other thing is, because of the way in which the information was published, and the other posts, and the chronological order of the posts, and the movement, you can see where someone is at a given time. We could track his movements, and we could verify that he had, in fact, been there on that day. Let's say Rafah on that day, let's say May 2024, and in northern Gaza on that day. And therefore, his account was amplified by the rest of the evidence he had provided. This is just one example. Another example, which you see quite frequently, is that they very purposely target civilian buildings and objects, hospitals, houses, etc., mosques, and blow them up and boast about doing that and show it in real time. So you hear the guy, you see a selfie, guy or girl, who's a man or woman, and then they blow it up and then they cheer.
And you saw this has been image that's been widely published. I've seen it on Al Jazeera of this kind of portly guy. I think he's got red hair and he's obviously an American. He almost sounds like a New Yorker and with wearing a helmet. You see the building, it was his Gaza University blowing up in the distance and he's going, yay!
But I mean, these types of examples exactly
I mean, I've got a list of these here that I went through your document. Indiscriminate bombing, targeted killing of non-combatants, including medical personnel and journalists, wanton destruction of homes, hospitals, schools, markets, and mosques, forcible starvation, looting.
Yeah. Regarding starvation, I can give you another example. We lodged a complaint against, in Italy, you must have heard about that last week, against the chairman or the head of COGAT, which is the administrative department of the IOF.
COGAT.
For the starvation of Gaza. And this guy was on, I'm not sure if he was on leave. He had appointments and meetings in Italy, in Europe. And we, of course, selectively, legally targeted him and lodged a complaint there with the evidence which he had provided himself. I mean, he was the highest ranking administrative guy within the military who was responsible for that. And we had his statements, his public statements on record with him boasting about starving Gazans. And we had, of course, the fact that they had been starved, which is, I mean, as clear as day. So that wasn't that difficult. And that, now I'm talking about somebody around the top of the chain of command who should have been indicted by the ICC, because that was that was easy. And we also lodged a complaint, I think that was 3 months ago now, against the head of the CLA, which is like COGAT, and someone who was equally culpable regarding the starvation of Gaza and the way in which they've been tortured, in our view, for the past year, longer, in fact, with evidence which looked like that. So these are, I mean, this isn't difficult. This isn't rocket science. It's quite easy. And especially after the ICJ repeatedly, not once, repeatedly pointed towards, for example, inflammatory use of language and the actions which the Israeli government and the IOF have been partaking in on a daily basis.
You're referring to the International Court of Justice, which is distinct from the ICC.
Exactly. Then it becomes quite easy. And the same goes for the ICC arrest warrants, which have now been confirmed by the pretrial chamber of the ICC. So, you know, it's simple.
Now, a lot of these guys, well, I don't know how many of them, you've indicated 33 of them are dual nationals, dual Israeli foreign nationals, 12 from France, 12 from the U.S., 4 from Canada. That's interesting. 3 from the U.K., 2 from the Netherlands. How many of these, are there more than just 33?
There are much more. This was just the document you're referring to. But before that, we already lodged a complaint, and the complaint is still pending here in the Netherlands against, if I'm not mistaken, 14 or 15 Dutch dual national IOF soldiers. That's separate from the list that you're referring to. And we now have a database with many more. I won't name numbers, but they're much more than 33, believe you me. Because the fact of the matter is, a large percentage of the Israeli population does have dual nationality because of the fact that many of them are immigrants from the US, from Holland, from other countries. So because of that, the actual number will be much more than 33. Don't pin me down on an exact amount, but we're looking at thousands. So, I mean, we are very realistic. And that's why we sent it not just to 10 countries whose nationals were IDF soldiers, but to 10 countries in general. The reason being, many countries have universal jurisdiction. These IOF soldiers go on holiday, sometimes using connecting flights, many a time, especially if they want to go to Bali or wherever, you know, where they often do go, or India, wherever, Thailand. And because of that, they might have to make a stopover. We need one of those countries, be it a Turkey, who's given a lot of lip service, but hasn't done much, with all respect to Turkish policy, or Dubai, or the Emirates. We'll see how far they go, looking at their Zionist connection, and other countries. They just need to put these people on the list, and as soon as they land, they'll be arrested.
And how do you find out that soldier A or B or C has jetted off to Bali or is heading for Brazil or Italy?
I can't tell you everything. So I can't tell you exactly how we do that, but we have eyes and ears everywhere, literally.
Huh. Tell me about these cases that we've heard about in the media of soldiers who've been almost been nabbed, like the guy who went to Brazil. Yeah. And I wonder, you know, how that works exactly. I mean, you get tipped off that this person is in Brazil, and you send you've got a cooperant in Rio de Janeiro who sends a message to the public prosecutor.
Of course, I can't tell you that. I can tell you that everything that we do is legal. Yeah. So there's no funny business whatsoever. In fact, I double check that as legal counsel to make sure everything can, in fact, withstand the legal tests. I mean, I've been a practicing criminal defense attorney for 22 years here in the Netherlands. So I know how to check those things. So we make sure the evidence has been obtained lawfully, including the tips, including the other information. But we get that information from our investigators who are on the lookout.
And how do these people find out? I mean, you know, you get tipped off that such and such person has gone off to Brazil. You immediately file a request that this person be detained. You provide evidence. And then in the case of this person in Brazil, they quickly get out of the country. They get tipped off. Like, how does that happen? How do they find out?
You mean how do they get tipped off?
How do they get tipped off that there's a warrant against them?
But generally what happens is that there's, I mean, one of these guys, I think he gave an interview to Israeli television in which he described the experience as worse than these were his words, worse than the 7th of October. These were his words, the way which he was describing it. So he literally, he was quite scared. What normally happens is people start calling them. And many a time it's the embassy or some ministry, I guess of diaspora, I'm just guessing now. But this is what we've heard from their interviews. So the authorities tip them off, especially the embassies, the local embassies, and or the ministry in Israel, which is responsible for them, and tries to get them home as soon as possible, or tries to have them move.
When do you think Harun Raza, the first Israeli soldier, is going to be, or officer, is going to be arrested in a foreign country in Europe or in South America or in North America or in Asia? When's that going to happen?
I expect it to be within a few months because one thing which the IOF and these war criminals have proven is they really believe that they're untouchable, which is fine. I mean, let them think that. Let them try us out. We're on their case. We're tracking them. If they touch any country with universal jurisdiction or any country which is inclined to prosecute, we'll legally pounce on them. Let's say somebody lands, an IOF war criminal lands in a country which does not have universal jurisdiction or has some limitations. We know that the person has to travel back. We know that the person might travel somewhere else. All we have to do is check out the region that he or she is in, check out what the most probable flight pattern is, and then lodge a complaint at either one end regarding somebody who's traveling around. For example, Brazil, the guy went to Argentina, where we directly the next day, the same day when he was there, we lodged a complaint there, and then he fled to Israel. So we weren't effective in having him move, although that was not the goal, of course. Or the stopovers, as I said, for example.
Any comments on Canada? These because you know I'm a Canadian. These four Canadians, at least four Canadians, dual Israeli Canadians. Can you provide me with any information about them without necessarily naming them?
Let me give you a general response to explain our position. In the past, we have lodged complaints just on the basis of dual nationality and the war crimes, of course, at the local level. However, we will be more successful if we have someone in the jurisdiction itself. So, for example, Canadians, they could be Dutch, they could be British, whoever. That's why we wait and we track them. And we move when we think it's prudent to move, looking at the end goal, which is to get somebody arrested, prosecuted, and sentenced. So maybe I've answered your question in that way, which means yes, we are looking at Canada as well as all other countries.
And you've got a half dozen Canadians, specific Canadians. You know who they are. You've got them in your sights.
We do. And we'll keep them in our sights. That's the strength of our organization. There are thousands of us. We have a very large network internally and externally of investigators. And because of that, we have enough manpower to keep tabs on nearly everybody. When there's universal jurisdiction, especially connected to war crimes or crimes against humanity, there isn't a statute of limitations in the national legislation. So that means even if we find out after 20 years, just like Simon Wiesenthal did, we can still pursue them. And that is actually what we are. We're not Palestinians, not all of us anyway, but we are the Gaza Simon Wiesenthal Center, if you will, which means just like he did, very rightfully so, regarding the Shoah and the Holocaust, he had patience and he had perseverance, and so do we. And we have pledged one thing to ourselves and to each other. We are not going to rest until our dying day, until we've got everybody, of course, including those people who are responsible for the murder of Hindrajab. So it's our promise to her, to her family, and to the Palestinian people that justice will be served.
How can people help?
Volunteer. Go to hindrajabfoundation.org or go to one of the social media, Instagram. We are on Facebook now. We are on, it's called Blue Sky, I think. Yeah. We have a Telegram channel. We are everywhere on social media. So please fill in the form, volunteer. We are built on volunteers, and without volunteers, we are nothing. And what we've seen is that anybody and everybody with who's honest and has a very strong sense of justice is always an asset. If you're a lawyer or an activist or an organizer or social media specialist or whoever.
Are there any particular specialties or areas of expertise that you're looking for?
Lawyers, of course, lawyers. Give us more lawyers. There aren't enough lawyers regarding jurisdictions. Again, we are massive right now, but it's always good to strengthen our teams, and by that, strengthen our resolve.
Because you need people who are able to turn around an affidavit in 3 or 4 or 5 hours and get it affirmed and certified and submitted to a court.
Exactly. So that's why we work with legal professionals. And I'm also working full-time within my own firm, alongside this work. Of course, this is a volunteer work. It's not like, and we're getting paid, and we do not want to get paid for this work, of course. It's all for our brothers and sisters over in Palestine. But that means that sometimes when I'm in court, I might not be able to use those hours to do something because of the amount of volunteers we have. No problem. The next lady or gentleman picks up the work and continues it. So it's perfect.
Haroon Raza, thank you so much for joining me in this discussion.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Haroon Raza is lead counsel for the Brussels-based Hindrajab Foundation. We'll link to the foundation's website at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Feeding cows seaweed? It might sound strange, but it could help farms reduce their climate impact. When animals like cows, goats, and sheep digest their food, they burp up methane, an extremely potent planet-warming gas. And when you add up all the farm animals in the world, that methane becomes a big problem for the climate.
There's 1.5 billion cows on the planet. And then there's another billion sheep and another billion goats.
Steve Meller is the CEO of CH4 Global. His company has developed a new cattle feed supplement made from Asparagopsis, a type of seaweed. Scientists have discovered that when cattle eat this seaweed, they produce a lot less methane. The company says their supplement can reduce methane from cows by at least 70%. And farmers only need to use a little for it to work.
Think of it like sprinkling salt on a meal. It's an additive. So it's less than 0.5% of the cow's total daily diet.
The company grows the seaweed in Australia, in huge ponds built on land that's not suitable for farming. And if Meller's group can scale up production in the coming decade, it could significantly help limit methane from the world's farm animals. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.